I nod. Aidan is telling the truth. He continues.
We took precautions most of the time. Jodie wanted to go on the pill, but we knew what Aunt Maggie would say if she found out.
Who did you tell?
Nobody, at first. But when Jodie got pregnant, she told my dad because she didn't want to keep practicing the difficult jumps. He wanted her to land the triple axel, but she knew that any fall could hurt the baby.
Did he know about you?
No, Jodie refused to say. Dad wanted her to get an abortion. He said nobody had to know, if they did it quietly, and that Jodie could keep skating and stay at school.
But she wanted to keep the baby,
says Cyrus. Aidan nods, stubbing out his cigarette. He reaches for another.
It's not illegal, you know. First cousins get married over time, and have babies, I checked. Charles Darwin married his first cousin, and so did Albert Einstein. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were cousins. It's not taboo or anything like that. The baby would have been fine.
You plan to run away,
says Cyrus.
Where to?
We figured we'd go to London and rent a place.
What about your law degree? The scholarship?
I don't want to be a lawyer. Never have. I only applied because of Mum. It was her dream, not mine.
What's your dream?
I want to write songs and produce them. People think that's pie-in-the-sky stuff, but I'm good. You should listen to my stuff. I got a CD.
He rummages in the bag at his feet and hands Cyrus a USB stick with the words Bedroom Recordings handwritten on the side.
I should be able to try, right?
Asks Aidan.
If it doesn't work out, I can go to university.
He's looking from face to face, wanting us to agree. He must have had this argument 1,000 times in his head, convincing himself before he risked talking to his parents.
They took DNA from Jodie's unborn child, says Cyrus. You're not the father.
No! You're wrong! Dad would never... She would never...
Again, Cyrus looks at me. Again, I nod. Aidan believes what he's saying, but that doesn't make it true.
Who knew that you were sleeping with Jodie?
Asks Cyrus.
Nobody.
What about your mother?
No. I mean, she almost caught us one day and went batshit crazy. I lied to her. I told her we were just fooling around. She read me the riot act, telling me that Jodie was underage and that she was my cousin, and that Dougal and Maggie would be heartbroken if they knew, and that I couldn't touch her like that again. I told her nothing had happened and promised her that nothing would.
When was this?
Aidan pauses, trying to remember.
Early September, maybe.
Before you knew that Jodie was pregnant?
Yeah.
Cyrus seems to be calculating the dates and rearranging the timelines.
On the night Jodie came to the caravan, what happened?
Nothing. I mean, she was cold and tired. Some old lech at a party had groped her and offered her money for sex, but she ran away.
What did you do?
I made her a cup of tea. We talked.
You slept together?
Aidan nods.
Why use a condom?
Force of habit,
he says, without irony.
What made Jodie go home that night?
Asks Cyrus. Aidan shakes his head, unable to explain.
When she left the caravan, I thought she was going to sneak into the house and sleep in Tasman's room. It's what she always did. I gave her my key.
What time was that?
Early hours. Jodie had to be up for training at 6.
Cyrus looks at the clock above the sink. It's almost 2 a.m.
You can sleep here tonight. We'll talk to the police in the morning.
He turns to me.
Can you help me make up a bed for Aidan?
I nod and empty the ashtray and put the mugs in the sink.
You should call your mother and tell her you're okay,
says Cyrus. Aidan balks.
I don't want to speak to her.
It can wait until morning.
Upstairs, Cyrus shows me where he keeps the spare sheets and blankets. We make the bed together, although he's pretty useless. I'm an expert at making beds with nurses' corners. They used to check mine every day at Langford Hall. He was telling the truth, I say.
Or what he believes to be the truth,
Cyrus replies. What are you going to do?
Let the police decide.
I hold a pillow under my chin and shake it into a slip. Do you know who killed Jodie Sheehan? I ask.
Not yet.
Cyrus frowns.
You always make that sound when you don't believe me. Chapter 60. The sun is almost liquid, angled so low that it slants through the blinds, reflecting from computer screens and empty whiteboards in the incident room. Aidan is sitting next to me, wearing yesterday's clothes, but he showered and combed his hair. Lenny is in a meeting. I can hear raised voices behind her closed office door. One of them I recognise. Antonia glances up from her desk.
I whisper, "Who is it?"
She mouths the words,
"Timothy Heller Smith and Jimmy Verbitch."
"Why?"
She motions me to move closer, cupping her hand over my ear.
"I'm not sure, but it could have something to do with Felix Sheehan. He's in hospital with a broken jaw and internal bleeding."
"What happened?"
"Lenny thinks he ripped off his supplier and copped a beating. Apparently he started off asking for police protection, but then changed his mind."
The office door opens suddenly. Antonia jumps up as though it has triggered a motor inside her. She bustles around, collecting coats and hats and scarves. Hella Smith recognises me and smiles mockingly.
"Ah, it's Dr. Haven, the shrink who won't shrink."
"Have we met?" I ask.
"No, but I've heard all about you. DCI Parvel seems very enamoured. Maybe it's a gender thing."
This he finds funny. I glimpse the loathing in Lenny's eyes, but know she won't say anything.
"I assume you two know each other,"
says Hella Smith, gesturing towards Jimmy. We nod, but don't shake hands.
"Councillor Verbitch has asked for and received a formal apology from Nottinghamshire Police for any hurt and inconvenience we have caused him. The Chief Constable feels that it is bordered on harassment."
"The Chief Inspector was only doing her job,"
says Jimmy.
"I'm sure it wasn't personal."
"It wasn't," says Lenny.
Hella Smith ignores the comment.
"I have also received a complaint from the Sheehan family accusing the police of being insensitive and heavy-handed."
"I'll draft a response,"
says Lenny.
"Yes, you do that."
Hella Smith notices Aidan.
"Let me guess, another suspect. Who is it this time?"
Aidan doesn't move. I glance at Lenny, wanting to talk to her privately, but this isn't the time or the place.
"This is Aidan Whittaker," I say. "He wants to make a statement."
"Did he kill Jodie Sheehan?"
"No. He claims to have got her pregnant."
"Another one. Should we start compiling a list?"
"She was murdered," I say, through clenched teeth.
"That case is closed," replies Hella Smith.
"With all due respect, sir, that's not your decision," says Lenny, stepping forward. "This is still my investigation, and I decide when it's closed."
Hella Smith smiles crookedly and scratches his cheek. It's like he's marking up an unseen ledger, keeping a list of whatever slights and abuses he will avenge later.
"Another example of why you're being transferred,"
he says, to nobody in particular.
"Maybe, but not until Monday."
The men leave. Hella Smith makes a barking sound all the way along the corridor, growing louder as he passes the incident room, letting everyone know what he thinks of Lenny. She gives me a lazy sideways glance, but doesn't hold my eyes.
Your timing is shit,
she mutters, addressing me but studying Aiden. He was with Jody that night, I explain. They were together in the caravan. He claims the baby is his.
He's wrong. Cousins don't match the DNA profile.
Aiden shakes his head.
No, I'm the father.
How do I know you're not saying this to protect your old man?
I'm not. I loved her.
Lenny sighs and yells to Antonia.
Get me Ness. On the phone? No, here. Now.
Chapter 61. Angel Face.
Poppy is barking at a squirrel in the garden. Be quiet, I tell her, worried the neighbours might complain about the noise. The Labrador spins and lopes across the soggy grass, pausing to look back at the squirrel, as if to say, I'll get you next time. I'm sitting on the back steps, barefoot and in my pyjamas, wrapped in a blanket. Poppy's tail thumps against my thigh as I scratch her behind the ears. Is this how happiness is meant to feel? I miss Cyrus. I miss hearing his footsteps and the creak of the plumbing when he turns on the taps and the clang of his weight dropping into the cradle. The house feels empty when he's not here. Wandering back inside, I think about reading some of his books or beading my hair or watching TV. I flick through the channels where people are buying houses in the country or showing off kitchen gadgets or yelling at each other in a courtroom. The mail flap echoes along the hallway. The newspapers are lying on the doormat, wrapped in plastic, along with the morning mail, two letters, and a postcard with an Irish stamp. It shows a picture of a rocky coastline in the Aran Islands. Four words are scrawled beside the address. Leave my parents alone. I have no idea what it means, but leave it on the desk for Cyrus. Unwrapping the newspaper, I read about Brian Whittaker's arrest. The photograph shows him sitting in the back of a police car with a coat over his head, which means it could be anyone. The story gives details of his skating career and how he'd coached Jody Sheehan since she could walk. The doorbell starts ringing and doesn't stop. Someone is holding his or her finger on the button. I answer, ready to complain, but a woman pushes past me, knocking me off balance. Where is he? Cyrus isn't here. She's moving from room to room, searching. Where's Aiden? They've gone to the police station. Get them back!
What?
I said get them back!
I can't.
Get them back!
She screams, frantic, desperate. I flinch, backing away.
Cyrus doesn't have a phone.
She swallows a deep breath and apologises.
Please, I have to talk to Aiden.
This must be Felicity Whittaker, Aiden's mother. She was at the house last night, but I didn't meet her.
I can send him a message.
Mrs. Whittaker steps closer as I type on my phone.
He has to bring Aiden. Nobody else. No police.
I press send. The message disappears. Poppy has come to the back door, whining and scratching, wanting to come inside.
Who's that?
My dog.
Where are you going?
To let her inside, I say. She won't hurt you.
No, leave her.
The blanket has dropped from my shoulders. She looks at my pyjamas.
Are you his daughter?
What? She speaks slowly, as though I'm retarded.
Are you his daughter?
No, he's... I'm a foster child.
Where is your mother?
Dead. The bluntness of my answer surprises her.
What happened to her?
It doesn't matter. Would you like a cup of tea?
No.
I could make coffee.
No.
She's pacing back and forth, knocking her fist repeatedly against her head, as though trying to dislodge a thought. She's mumbling. Poppy barks. I glance at the clock above the sink,
Why hasn't Cyrus called?
Call him,
she says, pointing to my phone. I told you. He doesn't have a mobile. I know it's weird. He doesn't have a landline either.
Don't bullshit me, girlie. Call him.
I'm not lying. I realise that she's going to hit me before it happens, but can't stop the blow. She backhands me across the face, knocking me sideways so that my head strikes the door jamb. I slide down the wall, seeing sparks when I blink. She takes hold of my ponytail and jerks my face around.
Call him. Tell him not to bring the police. I want Aiden. Nobody else.
Chapter 62. I glance at my pager and see Evie's number. You have to bring Aiden home, says the message. A moment later, a second one arrives. No police. I glance at Lenny.
What's wrong?
She asks. Can I use your phone? I call Evie's number, listening to it ring. She answers.
Cyrus?
Is everything okay?
Bring him back! Now!
Snarls Felicity Whittaker. Felicity?
I want Aiden.
He's talking to the detectives.
Stop him!
Why? What's wrong?
Tell him to shut up!
He's at West Bridgeford Police Station. Why don't you come here and talk to him?
Bring him here!
I can't do that. Silence for a long time, but I can hear her breathing. Are you there, Felicity? Let me talk to Evie.
Aiden's done nothing wrong,
she blurts. I know.
Tell the police.
I will. Put Evie on the phone.
No, you're not listening. Bring Aiden now.
He'll be home soon.
Bring him, or she gets hurt. I'll do it. I'll kill her. I'll kill myself. Bring Aiden, or she dies.
The line goes dead. My heart is suddenly where my brain should be, the blood pounding behind my temples. Vaguely, I'm aware of Lenny yelling orders across the near-empty incident room, calling for a tactical response team. No sirens, radio silence. In between firing off commands, she is asking me questions about Felicity Whittaker and the layout of the house. How many entrances or access points? Are the windows locked or unlocked? Could she be armed? How did she seem? Upset, I say.
Irrational?
Yes.
What about the girl, Evie? Is she likely to panic?
I hesitate, trying to think. I remember the incident at Langford Hall when Evie disarmed Brody. Back then, she had been so calm, it had bordered on serenity. She'll look to escape, I say. We're talking and moving, descending the stairs, into the parking area, where three unmarked police cars are waiting. Lenny pulls body armour from the boot of the first car and throws a black vest in my direction. Is that really necessary?
You wear it, or you stay here.
There are more questions on my journey, most of them about Felicity's state of mind.
Does she have any history of mental illness?
I don't know.
Why take a hostage?
She doesn't want Aiden talking to the police.
Why?
Maybe she's worried this will jeopardise his future. He's been offered a place at Cambridge to study law, a full scholarship.
Sleeping with his cousin won't jeopardise anything.
Jody was underage.
And he's not much older.
Lenny takes a call. I can only hear one side of the conversation.
No helicopters. A drone? How noisy is it? Okay, yeah. Evacuate whoever you can without alerting Mrs. Whittaker. Do it quietly.
Then he turns to me.
Do any of the neighbouring properties overlook the front or back of the house?
The front, yes.
Okay, we need a floor plan. You might have to sketch one. What room are they likely to be in?
The kitchen, maybe. It's at the back. We're getting closer to Woollerton Park. My pager beeps. It's another message from Evie. Where are you? Chapter 63. Angel Face.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hit you.
Mrs. Whittaker is fussing over me, looking for frozen peas in the freezer. I don't normally. I mean, I never hit Aiden or Tasman. I don't know what came over me. Her eyes are jittering from side to side as she paces the kitchen. I've seen someone overdose before, and I've seen loads of kids suddenly kick off because they're angry or high or hearing voices, but nothing like this. I'll wait upstairs, I say. No! I should get dressed. Stay here! But I need the loo. I cross my legs as though I'm busting. There must be one downstairs. I reach for my phone, but she takes it from me. What if he calls? I ask. I'll answer it. The loo is off the laundry. I lock the door and glance at the window. It's too small for me to crawl out. Maybe I can stay here until Cyrus arrives. I can't hear anything happening, she says, from the far side of the door. You're making me nervous. Piss or get off the pot. My phone is ringing. She answers, asking, Where's Aiden? I don't hear the reply, but it must be Cyrus. After another pause, she knocks. He wants to talk to you. You have to tell him you're okay. I unlock the door and step out. Cyrus is on speakerphone. Hey, I say.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
Has she threatened you?
Asks Cyrus. Mrs. Whittaker interrupts.
She's fine. Where's Aiden?
You can come out and see him.
No!
He didn't hurt Jody. You don't have to protect him. He's giving the police a statement, that's all.
She curses under her breath.
No statements.
You can't make demands.
I want my son! She screams, grabbing a knife from the wooden block beside the stove.
Please, stay calm, says Cyrus.
Don't tell me to be calm! She has a knife, I yell, ducking under her arm and bolting for the door. She grabs my hair and hauls me back. I cry out in pain. Cyrus has heard it all.
Don't hurt her,
he pleads.
Evie, can you hear me?
Mrs. Whittaker holds the knife to my neck.
Answer him. I'm here.
Are you hurt?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
He exhales with relief, but doesn't say anything for a while. It's like he's lost for words. Finally, he says,
Let me come inside, Felicity.
Not without Aiden.
How about we do a swap? Take me instead of Evie.
No.
She's just a kid.
So is Aiden.
The police aren't going to let him walk into a house where you've threatened someone. Not when you're holding a knife. Talk to me.
Get me Aiden. Then we'll talk.
Chapter 64. Police cars have been parked diagonally across the road to create a staggered series of checkpoints, each one closer than the next. The outer ring is 100 yards from the house, where uniformed officers are keeping spectators behind barricades. Most of them are neighbours, who are no doubt filling the vacuum of uncertainty with breathless rumours of terrorism or a domestic siege.
The hostage negotiator is still 40 minutes away, says Lenny.
I'm trained, I say.
You're personally involved.
I know the layout of the house. I know Felicity Whittaker.
I'm not giving her a second hostage.
What if she agrees to release Evie?
She just refused.
More police are arriving. Men dressed in black, wearing body armour and helmets, carrying rifles, battering rams and shields. The head of the tactical response team is straight out of Hollywood casting, with chiselled features and a Clooney-esque haircut.
We'll be ready in 15,
he tells Lenny, who remains in overall command until negotiations are deemed to have failed.
Do we have eyes?
She asks.
We had a sighting in the kitchen before the blinds were lowered, says Edgar. What about ears? The directional microphones aren't picking up much.
Lenny looks at me.
Phone her again.
I dial Evie's mobile. It goes to her voicemail. I try again. Nothing.
Can we get Aiden here?
I ask.
He's on his way.
Lenny motions towards the tactical response officers who are taking up positions behind hedges and parked cars and in neighbouring properties with windows that overlook the house.
What would you do?
She asks. Give her more time. She's a middle-aged mother of two, not a wanted terrorist. Lenny gazes at the house as though contemplating tomorrow's headlines.
Okay, but first I want confirmation that Evie Cormack is unharmed.
Grabbing a loudhailer from the front seat of her car, she signals for me to follow. The birds have gone quiet, and traffic noise drops away, leaving a soundtrack of our shoes crushing seed pods on the footpath. We reach the front gate. Lenny raises the megaphone.
Mrs. Whittaker, I know you can hear me. I'm DCI Parvel. We met a few weeks ago.
We wait, watching. Nothing moves behind the curtains.
Your son is on his way, but I can't help you unless you help me. I need proof that Evie Cormack is safe and unharmed.
The front door opens a crack. Felicity yells,
She's safe! I'll need more than your word for it.
The door opens wider, and this time Evie emerges, dressed in her red flannelette pyjamas, printed with penguins. She's barefoot and looks younger than 18. Younger than 14. Too young. Felicity Whittaker has her arm wrapped around Evie's neck, crooked at the elbow, using her as a human shield. She's holding a bottle of clear liquid in her right hand. She holds it aloft and begins emptying it over Evie. Fluid splashes across her head and shoulders, into her eyes. Evie screams, trying to cover her face. What is it? Paint thinners? Gasoline? Turpentine? Evie tries to drop and roll, but Felicity holds her upright and tosses the empty bottle away. It bounces down the steps and rolls onto the grass. She pulls a cigarette lighter from her pocket and holds it against Evie's cheek.
You know what I want!
The door closes. Chapter 65 Angel Face.
My eyes are burning. My mouth, my nostrils, my ears. Every hair follicle is on fire. It's like red-hot wires have been driven through my pupils straight into my brain. I use my pyjama sleeves to wipe at my eyes, but the liquid is all over me, soaking the fabric, clinging to my skin. Dragged backwards along the hallway, I'm dumped in the library, where I curl up on the floor. More liquid is splashed across the desk and bookshelves, the fumes scalding my throat, making me gag. Why are you doing this? I scream. They aren't listening. That's not my fault. She grabs my hair again. How many entrances? Two, front and back. She pulls me from room to room where she closes the blinds and curtains, checking the windows are locked. Water, I plead. My eyes. We're in the kitchen. She holds my head over the sink and turns on the tap. I splash water onto my face, but still can't see properly. Bottles and cans are scattered across the floor. She has emptied the shelves in the laundry and kitchen, examining the labels, keeping some bottles and discarding others. I spent hours tidying those shelves, putting paints on one side and cleaning products on the other, with the labels facing out. She makes me sit down and unspools a roll of masking tape, wrapping it around my wrists and up my forearms. You don't have to do this. Shut up! I'm not Dr. Haven's daughter. We're not related. You're living here. I'm visiting. You must mean something to him. The statement jangles something inside me. Does Cyrus care about me? He must do. He didn't send me back to Langford Hall. He let me have Poppy. Darling Poppy. Poor Poppy. She's whining from the back steps, wondering why she's being ignored. In a different life, in a different house, I listened to dogs barking as Terry was tortured to death. He stopped begging after a while. Then he stopped talking, which infuriated them even more. He groaned and cried, and I wished they would hurry. I wished they would finish. I wished his suffering would end. I've heard people die before. Some hardly make a squeak, while others fought like drowning cats in a sack. My father, my mother, my sister. They left me alone with the nameless men and the faceless men. Only they do have names, and they do have faces. And I remember every one of them. Next time, I will pull the trigger. Next time, I won't hesitate.
Chapter 66. Lenny is yelling orders over the two-way, wanting fire crews in place and the gas and electricity turned off to the house. The nearest hospital burns unit is on standby. Her eyes spark with a fresh energy, as though she's operating on a different level to everybody else, seeing several moves ahead.
Where is Aidan Whittaker?
10 minutes away, replies Edgar.
No sirens, says Lenny.
She glances at me.
Tell me something I don't know.
She's desperate.
That's obvious, come on.
She's delusional.
Why?
This is about Aidan. She's protecting him.
Why?
Maybe she thinks he killed Jody.
Did he? The kid could be playing us.
He's not lying.
How can you be so sure?
I can't tell her about Evie and what she can do. Last night she asked me if I knew the killer's name. She didn't believe me when I said no. I thought she'd made a mistake and that she wasn't infallible after all.
An idea rises from the depths of my unconscious mind, becoming clearer as it nears the surface. When I chatted to Maggie Sheehan at the church, she said that Felicity had struggled to get pregnant. It took her years of IVF, one failure after another. She almost went mad, Maggie said. Then Aidan arrived, her miracle child, and she projected onto him all her dreams and unfulfilled ambitions. A mother's job is to protect her children, to keep them safe. There must be more. Suddenly, I see it. Aidan, Jody, Brian, Dougal, Felicity. They are like cards in a poker hand, a full house. That's what Evie saw last night. Some shard of light from my subconscious mind. The tell.
Let me go in, I say. I know why she's doing this.
Lenny hesitates and glances at the tactical response group. She hands me a radio device that clips to my belt.
Give us the word and we're going in. If that happens, keep your head down.
Moments later, I'm walking alone past parked cars, cutting across the grass verge to the front gate. I press the doorbell, smelling the turpentine that has been splashed on the threshold. A voice from inside.
Aidan?
No, it's Cyrus.
Where's Aidan?
He's on his way.
I'll torch this place. I'll burn her first.
I promise you he's coming.
Felicity is talking to me from the hallway with only the door separating us.
I'm just going to sit here, I say,
lowering myself onto the step and leaning against the brickwork. I pluck a flower from the overgrown garden and begin picking off the petals one by one. The silence is filled with quiet breathing.
I had a pen friend when I was at school,
I say, remembering the postcards that were stuck on Felicity's fridge.
Her name was Camille. She lived in Manila, in the Philippines. We wrote to each other every month for about 10 years. Letters at first, then emails. We promised that one day we'd meet up.
Did you ever do it?
We came close. We were both turning 25 and we planned to celebrate our birthdays in Singapore.
What happened?
She had a baby. A little boy.
I pluck another petal from the flower.
You could still make your world tour. See all your friends,
I say. Felicity makes a mocking sound. She's closer now, only inches away from me. I imagine her leaning her back against mine, with only the door separating us.
I've heard some of Aidan's music. He's very good.
Music is just a hobby. He's going to Cambridge. He won a scholarship.
Did he apply for that, or did you? Felicity ignores me.
He was a straight A student. His teacher said he was the best and brightest. He's going to be a lawyer. He's going to make a difference.
A difference for who? I ask. Felicity goes quiet. The pause stretches out for so long, I wonder if she's still leaning against the door. What does Aidan want? I ask. Have you asked him? Nothing. I know it feels good, basking in Aidan's successes, but if children are pushed into fulfilling parental expectations, they can fail to explore other opportunities. They can feel stifled, trapped.
I know my son.
I'm sure you do. But Aidan is scared of disappointing you. He wants you to listen. I've treated kids who feel pressured to fulfill some sort of destiny. Some achieve great things, but others suffer anxiety and depression, which feeds addictions. Some even sabotage themselves rather than risk disappointing those who expect too much.
That's not me,
she says savagely. I talked to Aidan. He was sleeping with Jodie. He got her pregnant.
No, it was Brian.
You've known all along, haven't you? Silence. I can hear her breathing. She seems to swallow her answer. Glancing along the front path, I see Lenny moving into place. Aidan is with her. They're both wearing body armour. Firemen have unspooled hoses and hooked them to the nearest hydrants, positioning them just in case. I know what you did, Felicity. I know why you did it. You couldn't fall pregnant. It wasn't your fault. You did everything the doctors suggested, the vitamins and diets, rounds of IVF. How many times did you try?
4,
she whispers. That must have been expensive.
It almost broke us. Ryan didn't want to keep paying. If it happens, it happens, he said.
That must have been hard. Being around Maggie made it worse because she had Felix. Every day you were being reminded of what you couldn't have. She gives a hiccuping sob. In your desperation to have a child, you slept with your brother-in-law. Dougal is Aidan's father. Not Brian. Felicity groans. Nobody could ever find out, not Maggie, or Aidan, or your husband. That's why you couldn't let Aidan fall in love with Jodie. You couldn't let them sleep together or have a baby.
It was incest. It was wrong,
she whispers. When Brian told you that Jodie was pregnant, you didn't know that Aidan was the father until you overheard them together in the caravan that night. You confronted Jodie. You begged her to have an abortion.
I wanted her to understand, says Felicity. Why wouldn't she listen?
You followed her.
She was being foolish. She was risking Aidan's future and her own. He's going to Cambridge. She's going to the Olympics.
Did you tell her that Aidan was her half-brother? I hear another stifled sob.
She wouldn't have believed me.
What happened?
I wanted her to hear what I was saying. To listen. She was ruining everything.
You tried to stop her?
I didn't hit her hard.
What did you use?
A piece of iron. A fence post. It was lying on the ground, near the bridge. I only hit her once. I thought she was pretending, you know. I shook her. I said her name. Put my hand on her chest.
He pushed her body into the water.
I thought she was dead. I thought I'd killed her.
She was still alive. Felicity moans. Lenny is signalling me from the road. Aidan is with him. He's here, I say. The police have brought Aidan.
I hear the floorboards creak as Felicity stands. Moments later, the library curtains twitch and open a crack.
I want to talk to him, she says. I need to explain.
Come out and you can talk to him.
No, send him in.
That's not going to happen. Her voice changes.
Send him in or I'll kill her!
Please stay calm, I say. If you lose your temper, the police will storm this place.
Let them try.
You don't want that. Let me come inside. Swap me for Evie. I can make them understand. I can get Aiden for you. There is a long pause before the lock turns. The door swings inwards. Felicity has her arm around Evie's neck. Let her go.
Not until you're inside. Don't believe her, yells Evie.
Her eyes are swollen and almost closed, and vomit stains the front of her pyjamas. I slip past them into the hallway, which reeks of turpentine, gas, and alcohol. Felicity keeps her distance, holding the cheap plastic cigarette lighter to Evie's cheek.
Put your hands through the railings,
she says, pointing towards the stairs. Felicity kicks a roll of packing tape across the floor and tells Evie to bind my wrists. Evie struggles to unspool the tape because her own wrists are bound, but manages to secure my hands while Felicity stands over her. Turn off the gas and open the windows, I say. We have to air the house. Felicity ignores me, jerking her thumb towards the door, telling Evie to get out.
I'm not going without Cyrus.
Please, Evie, just go, I say.
She's going to set the house on fire. She's poured stuff all over your books.
Felicity waves the lighter in front of Evie's face, threatening to flick at the flint wheel.
Last chance.
Evie seems to react instinctively, spinning around and scrambling up the stairs. Blindly, she collides with a wall and bounces off, but keeps going, disappearing into the upper floors.
This is madness. She has to get out. Stupid little cow,
curses Felicity, climbing past me on the stairs. Leave her, I say. You have other things to worry about. Lenny's voice interrupts me, projected through a loudhailer.
Mrs. Whittaker, we have your son.
Chapter 67. Angel Face.
I squeeze between boxes in the turret room, navigating by touch. I slide my hand beneath a pillow until my fingers close around the oily rag. The pistol. I rack the slide, putting a bullet in the chamber, pointing it towards the door. There are no footsteps on the stairs, no blurry shadows in the doorway. I put down the handgun and pick up the knife. Jamming the handle inside a closed drawer, I lean my hip against the front panel to keep the blade steady. I run my wrists back and forth against the sharpest edge, cutting the masking tape before ripping it with my teeth, spitting out bits of torn plastic. I can hear Cyrus yelling my name, telling me to get out, until another voice drowns him out, coming from outside. Feeling my way between boxes, I stand on tiptoes at the window. Through watery eyes, I see two figures standing near the front gate. I recognize Aiden's voice.
Mom, it's me.
Mrs. Whittaker answers, repeating his name, as though wanting to be sure.
What are you doing, Mum?
Yells Aiden.
I'm so sorry, baby. I didn't mean. I need to explain.
Okay. Are you coming out?
Listen, baby.
Her voice seems to break.
You're going to hear some things about me, but you have to believe that everything I did was for you.
What did you do?
I tried to protect you. I wanted you to be happy.
I was happy.
You and Jody. It was wrong. You couldn't be with her, not like you were.
Why?
The question brings silence. Aiden asks again.
Mom, why couldn't I be with Jody?
Felicity answers in a wheedling, sorrowful voice.
She was your half-sister.
You mean my cousin?
Says Aidan, less certain now.
No.
How can she be my half-sister?
I couldn't get pregnant. Not with your dad.
So, who is my father?
Felicity answers hoarsely.
Your Uncle Dougal.
Aidan doesn't respond.
Are you there, baby? I know it's a shock. I know I should have told you.
Aidan's voice changes.
Did you hurt Jodie?
Another pause, followed by a defeated moan.
It was an accident. I didn't mean it. You have to forgive me.
He says nothing.
Aidan?
Without a word, he turns and brushes past the shoulders of the detective, walking past the police cars and the barricades and the watching crowd. Mrs. Whittaker is calling after him, begging him. He doesn't stop.
Chapter 68. It's over, Felicity. Put down the lighter. She's kneeling on the hallway rug, hunched over, breathing raggedly. Words get caught in her throat. She tries again.
What have I done? What have I done?
Listen to me. You have to open the windows. The house is full of gas. Rocking on her knees, she holds her stomach, moaning. You can get Aidan back. Explain things to him. It's not too late. Right now, we have to get out of here. She's not listening to me. I hear Lenny on the loudhailer.
Mrs. Whittaker, can you hear me? You talked to your son. I want you to come outside.
She doesn't respond. I can picture the SWAT team outside, ready to break down the doors. The smallest spark will light this place up.
Give us a minute, I yell to Lenny.
I concentrate on Felicity, who can't see beyond her misery.
It was an accident, I say. I don't think you meant to hurt Jodie, but what you're doing now is making things worse.
I've ruined everything,
she sobs.
He'll never forgive me.
You made some bad decisions. Don't make another one. Open the windows. Let's walk out of here together.
It's too late.
It's only too late if you give up, I say. If something happens to you, it won't end the pain. You'll be passing it on to Aidan and Tasmin.
They'll be better off if I'm dead.
You'll stain their lives. You'll be betraying them. Rejecting them.
She is staring at the cigarette lighter, which is cupped in her hands like an offering. An answer. A key.
I lost my parents and my sisters. You know the story. Not a day goes by when I don't wonder if I could have saved them. If I'd come straight home from football practice. If I hadn't stopped for chips. If I hadn't ridden my bike past Ailsa Piper's house. What if? Maybe. If only. Don't let the same thing happen to Aidan. Come on. Let's get out of here. I yell up the stairs. Evie, it's time to go. She doesn't answer. Can you hear me, Evie? We're leaving.
Chapter 69. Angel Face.
I can hear you. I'm on the landing, peering through the wooden railings. My eyes are swollen shut, and the shapes below me are vague and indistinct, like I'm watching them from the bottom of a swimming pool. Cyrus is sitting on a lower step, with his hands taped around the wooden spindles. Mrs. Whittaker is kneeling in the hallway.
You have to open the doors and windows, then go outside, get away from the house.
I descend, touching the wall with my right hand. I'm holding the pistol behind my back. As I get closer, I can see Mrs. Whittaker more clearly, but not her face. I want to see her face.
Open the windows, Evie, then leave.
What about you?
The police will cut me free.
Stay where you are!
Mrs. Whittaker gets to her feet, swaying, sweating. I am between steps. The gun is heavy in my hand. I pull it out, aiming at the center of her chest. Cyrus takes a sharp breath. He utters my name and the word, no. She turns to face me, holding the cigarette lighter in her hand, her thumb on the flint wheel.
Don't do it, says Cyrus. The gas.
I realize my mistake, but I don't lower the gun. She's not going to let us go, I say.
Yes, she is. We're all getting out.
Are you letting us go? I ask. She doesn't answer. The gas and fumes are making me lightheaded. Rocking forward, I catch myself before I fall and slide down onto a step, holding the gun in my lap, no longer aiming. Cyrus looks up at me.
We're getting out of here.
Mrs. Whittaker hasn't spoken. I give her the evil eye. It's the look I used on Guthrie and Miss MacReady and kids who pissed me off at Langton Hall. You're too selfish to let us go, I say. It's always been about you. You wanted a baby so badly you cheated on your husband. You wanted Aidan to go to Cambridge because it made you look good. You wanted Jodie to get rid of the baby because it threatened your secret. You're such a coward you can't even die alone. Anger flares in her eyes. You asked me about my mother. You see this? I open the palm of my left hand and show her a tortoiseshell button the size of a 50-pence piece. It's all I have left of her. She had this bright red coat with a fur-lined collar that she said made her feel like a Russian Tsarina. I think that means princess. She was wearing it when they found her body. I hugged her for as long as I could, until they had to bend back my fingers to make me let go. When she'd gone, I found this button in my fist. I close my fingers and hold it against my cheek. She gave up, just like you're doing. She abandoned me. She pushed me away. For years, I told myself that I didn't blame her. But I'll never forgive her, because she can't tell me why. There is a beat of silence, and I wonder if anyone is listening. Slowly, Mrs. Whittaker gets up from her knees. She glances into the kitchen. I'll turn off the gas. You open the door, she says. I slide down the stairs until I reach Cyrus. I don't have the knife.
Open the front door,
he says, nodding along the hallway. I'm a step below him when I hear a surprised cry, or half a curse. In that same instant, the house seems to breathe in and then out, as though someone has suddenly opened the window of a moving car, lifting dust and litter from the floor. The world explodes around us, filling the air with wood, plaster, dust, and debris. Flames shoot out of the kitchen doorway and suck back again as the walls buckle. Mrs. Whittaker appears, her face blackened, eyes white and wide with shock. She touches her smoking head, as though seeking physical proof, and looks at me curiously, before collapsing forwards. The entire back of her head has disappeared, and her clothes have burnt off like a plastic doll held too close to the fire. The whooshing sound returns, and fire rolls across the hallway ceiling to the library. I look at my pyjamas and know I can't survive. Cyrus grabs my arm, yelling for me to get out. How? There's no escape. The kitchen ceiling has collapsed, leaving the claw-footed bath where the table used to be. Flames have reached the front rooms, blocking the hallway. I hear the sound of smashing glass. Hoses are blasting water through the windows, turning spray to steam.
Get out, Evie! Get out!
I pull up the tape around his wrists and run my fingers down the lathe-turned spindle. Bending my leg, I kick hard, but I'm barefoot and don't have the strength to break the wood. I scramble up the stairs and retrieve the pistol. Holding the barrel against the spindle, I unlock the safety and pull the trigger. The noise is louder than I expect, louder than the guns on TV and in films. Cyrus pulls free, scrambling to his feet, taking me with him.
This way,
he says, tugging at my sleeve, wanting me to follow. What about her?
She's dead.
Chapter 70.
Christ, Evie, where in God's name did you get a gun?
We've reached the landing. Thick black smoke has filled the stairwell. Evie is coughing so hard she doubles over, curling up on the floor.
Stay with me,
I yell, making her focus. I put her hands on the back of my belt and close her fingers.
Don't let go.
I crawl blindly across the landing, leading Evie. Feeling my way, I find her bedroom door and then her bed. My head bumps against the far wall. I reach for the sash window. I pull it up and lean outside, taking deep gulps of air. Evie? She's let go of me. I drop to my knees and feel for her, touching her hair. At that moment, flames sweep past the bedroom door, feeding on the oxygen from the open window. I drag her to her feet and lean her body outside, telling her to breathe. Poppy is below us in the garden, barking and leaping up the wall, planting her paws on the bricks as though wanting to climb. I lift Evie onto the window ledge with her feet dangling out. The garden is 20 feet below us. A jump like that will break her legs. Where are the ladders? The firemen? On the wrong side of the house. I take Evie's wrists and lower her down so that she's dangling above Poppy, but it's still too high.
Let go,
she yells, as a window blows out beneath us and glass scatters through the shrubbery. I notice a downpipe to my right, but it's too far for Evie to reach. 4 feet? More? I begin to move my shoulders, swinging her back and forth, building up momentum. She gets the idea and kicks with her legs, swinging out further, but I can't hold her much longer. Her fingertips touch the downpipe, but she's unable to hold on and slides away. I swing her one more time and let go. She wraps her hands around the black painted metal and clings on, slipping down, safe. It's my turn. I can't make a jump like that. I doubt if the pipe can take my weight. These old houses know how to burn with their dry timbers and drafty rooms. My history is in flames. Family photographs, books, heirlooms, memories. Smoke billows past me, and I can't see the pipe anymore. I can't see Evie or Poppy. I can't breathe. I hear her voice, yelling at me, but not the words. I lower myself out of the window, clinging by my fingertips, my shoes scrabbling for a toehold in the mortared bricks. I'm ready for the fall, for whatever comes. But as I let go, strong hands find my feet, directing me onto the rungs of a ladder, helping me down one step at a time through the smoke. My feet touch soft earth and I wheel around, stumbling a dozen paces before falling to my knees, coughing as though my lungs might slither out of my throat and convulse on the grass. Evie has her arms around me, her head buried in my neck. The girl without tears is crying. Her wet cheeks are smeared with soot that clings to her like a second skin, except for around her eyes, giving her the appearance of an emaciated cartoon panda. I wrap my arms around her, holding her, feeling her sob. Meanwhile, jets of water arc over the rooftop, falling onto our heads like rain.
Where did you get the gun?
I stole it from Felix.
Why?
In case they come.
Chapter 71 Angel Face.
I'm sitting on my bed, sticking pictures in a scrapbook. Cyrus will be here soon. He tries to come every day, when he can, bringing me cigarettes and chocolate fingers and pictures of Poppy. Poppy in the park, Poppy chasing squirrels, Poppy drinking from the bird bath, Poppy wading in the pond. Langford Hall is the same, the food, the routines, the staff. I'm used to it now. I feel safe here. I once read a story about how inmates sometimes get so used to being behind bars, they don't want to leave. I can't imagine myself ever getting to be like that. But I can survive this. I've lived through worse. Other girls my age are going to parties, or getting a job, or hanging out with friends. But I don't want any of those things. I wouldn't know what to do with that sort of life. That's why I don't have a calendar on the wall, or a clock in my room. I don't want to see time passing. Instead, I've become an expert at existing and letting each day play out like the one before. I miss Poppy. I miss Cyrus. I wish he didn't blame himself for what happened. It was nobody's fault, I told him. Bad luck follows me around.
You don't believe in luck,
he replied, and I knew that he understood. Cyrus can't foster me again. They say he put me in danger and involved me in a murder investigation. The gun would have sealed the deal. I was ready to take the blame, but Cyrus wouldn't let me. He said they'd keep me locked up for longer, or send me to an adult prison or a general psych hospital. Guthrie would love that. So I told the police that Felicity had the gun, and nobody could prove otherwise. Davina knocks on the door.
Your boyfriend's here?
He's not my boyfriend.
Well, why are you smiling?
Fuck off.
I love you too.
She laughs as she disappears down the corridor, tossing her dreads and swinging her hips. Cyrus pokes his head around the corner.
Hi.
Hello. He hugs me. I stiffen. I wonder if I'll ever get used to someone touching me like that.
I have a surprise,
he says. More photographs.
Better.
He wants me to close my eyes. I look at him suspiciously, but obey, letting him lead me out of my room and along the hallway. He tells me to mind my step when he opens the sliding door to the courtyard. Poppy is tied to a baby tree, trying to rip it out of the ground. Let loose, she leaps all over me, pushing me backwards onto the grass, licking my face and hands. Cyrus sits on a concrete bench and watches while we chase, wrestle and run. Later, exhausted, I sit beside him. Normally I'd light a cigarette, but I'm trying to quit.
How have you been?
He asks. Fine.
Are you sleeping?
Yeah. He always starts this way, with the simple questions, before he begins asking me about my dreams and earliest memories, my fears and regrets.
Victims of childhood abuse often dissociate,
he says, talking like a textbook.
They block out cognitive links and emotions. Sometimes they do it so completely, it's as if they never consciously experienced trauma. That could be why you have so few memories.
It could be, I say.
Whatever was done to you as a child, it wasn't your fault.
I know.
You don't have to blame yourself.
I don't. I know what Cyrus wants. Details. Facts. He wants to climb down into the same sewer that I escaped from. He wants to join me in the filth and lead me out again. He wants to know what went through my mind during all those hours, days, and weeks. What I heard. Why I stayed hidden. How I managed to stay alive. I remember it all. I remember nothing important.
I can understand you wanting to forget some things,
he says.
But don't you want to know who you are, or if you have family?
I have no family.
You mentioned your mother.
I won't talk about her.
What about your childhood?
It doesn't matter.
It does to me,
says Cyrus.
And it will to you, if you let it.
I sigh and close my eyes. You want to go where I have been?
Yes.
To see what I have seen.
I think I'm owed.
I can't go back there.
I'm not asking you to go back.
Yes, you are. You want to open up my mind and peer inside, but I'm not a plaything. I'm not an experiment.
I know what he did to you. What he took.
I feel myself getting angry.
You know nothing.
Where did he find you?
He didn't find me.
Come on, Evie, help me. Don't let this monster win.
He's not a monster.
He kidnapped you. He locked you up.
No.
He deserved to die.
Don't you dare say that.
Hostages often grow attached to their captors, but that's not love, Evie. Kidnapping a child, imprisoning her, abusing her. You can't think that's love.
You don't understand.
Explain it to me.
My eyes are fractured with tears that refuse to fall. "You want to know about love?" I whisper. "Love is allowing yourself to be tortured to death rather than tell people where someone is hiding. Love is dying slowly and horribly rather than betraying them. You think Terry was a monster. You think he locked me in a room and abused me. You're wrong. He died rather than tell them where I was hiding. He saved me."
"Saved you from who?"
"I can't tell you."
"Why?"
"He made me promise."
"That's not a promise, Evie. It's a threat."
I give him a pitying stare and shake my head.
"Just tell me your real name,"
he says.
"Surely I deserve that much."
"I can't."
"Why?"
"Everybody I love dies. I can't let that happen to you."
Chapter 72. My nightmares no longer involve my family. Evie inhabits my dreams, calling my name, hiding in a dark place as chaos unfolds around her. I cannot save her. I can never run fast enough, or jump high enough, or reach far enough to grab her fingertips as she falls past me into the void. Awake, screaming, damp with sweat, my heart hammering and her name dying on my lips. I don't know what triggered the explosion that killed Felicity Whittaker and destroyed part of my house. It could have been the central heating kicking in, or static electricity, or maybe Felicity changed her mind. Evie doesn't believe that. She saw the truth. I was wrong about many things. Terry Boland didn't abduct Evie and lock her in a secret room. He didn't sexually abuse her or force her to live off scraps and dog food. I don't know what is more disturbing, the notion of his innocence or the knowledge that he died protecting her. One thing is worse, the realization that she heard it happen. She listened to him screaming as the acid was poured into his ears and hot pokers burnt away his eyelids. She heard them calling her name, ripping up carpets, toppling furniture, punching holes through walls. How many days did they search for her? How many nights? Come out, wherever you are. Evie stayed hidden. She's still hiding. It's why she took the gun. It's why she slept with a knife beneath her pillow. It's why she constantly looks over her shoulder, searching for figures in the shadows. People watching her from doorways, or parked cars, or white vans. Sometimes late at night, when I hear a car door slam or footsteps on the pavement, or the scaffolding rattle, I imagine someone is climbing towards Evie's old room, trying to find her. I get up and navigate around the paint tins and bags of plaster, wishing the builders would finish soon. I check the windows are locked and go back to bed, but I won't sleep again. Evie will stay at Langford Hall, at least until next September when she turns 18. I won't be allowed to foster her again, but Caroline Fairfax is quietly hopeful that Evie's release date will be honoured. After that, I don't know what will happen. Maybe they'll send her to a secure psych unit like Arnold Lodge in Leicester, or she'll begin a program of day release. I'm hoping for the latter. Will Evie ever be free? I wish I knew. It's like that old story of the man who falls into the river and is dragged downstream towards the waterfall. A fisherman holds out a rod and says, "Grab hold, I'll pull you in." But the man replies, "It's okay. God will save me." Then a hiker leans from a fallen log and says, "Grab my hand, I'll lift you out." But the man waves to him and says, "God will save me." Finally, a helicopter hovers overhead and a crewman throws down a rope ladder. The drowning man ignores the offer, saying, "Don't worry, God will save me." Moments later, he crashes over the waterfall and perishes on the rocks below. Later, at the gates of heaven, he says to God, "Hey, didn't you see me down there? Why didn't you save me?" And God replies, "I tried 3 times, but you turned me away."
I'm the last person who should be telling religious jokes, heathen that I am. But Evie Cormack cannot do this on her own. Many years ago, a university lecturer of mine, Joe O'Loughlin, told me that a truly effective psychologist is someone who commits, who goes into the darkness to bring someone out. When a person is drowning, someone has to get wet, he said. I'm ready to get wet, Evie. Hold on. You've been listening to Good Girl, Bad Girl by Michael Robotham. Read by Joe Jameson. Text copyright Michael Robotham 2019. Production copyright Hachette Audio UK 2019. This has been an Hachette Audio production. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.